So, hey, good people. It's your girl, Fredrika Easley. And I am here with the People Are Blunt with two amazing individuals. I'm going to start off with my co-host, the beautiful Melanie Davis. Say hey to the people.
Hey to the people. How's everybody doing? Be well. Good to be in this space.
Absolutely. And so we have a man who needs no introduction. Period, but definitely in the cannabis space, he is always moving and shaking. Mr. Tahir Johnson, how are you?
Yo, what's up, y'all? Appreciate that. How you doing, Fredrika and Melanie?
I'm good. It's been a busy day, but look, ain't no point in complaining.
Hey, busy is good, right? If you're not busy, I like that better than the alternative, so I'll take it.
It's true, though.
Correct. And Melanie, how you doing? We like to start off asking and just doing a wellness check, if you will, in terms of how people are doing before we jump into to being blunt.
You know, we're doing good. We're finally back in Albuquerque, New Mexico, my hometown. What up? El Burque 505. Especially Los Padillas out there. Gotta give some love. So it's been a week back home after 6 weeks of touring California and vibing out there. Crossing paths a whole bunch with great people like to hear. And Fredrika, the two of you got to finally meet, right? In person. This was the first time. Mm-hmm. That was MJ BizCon 2021. Yeah. I think a lot of people came together, right?
Yo, this is like the first time I met half the people that I feel like I talk to regularly in real life. It was like I've seen you on Zoom a million times, and like seeing people's faces, crazy. Like one of my coworkers I actually met for the first time, and I imagine this dude was like short. He was like 6'7". So I had so many of those experiences at MJ Biz over like the past couple weeks. It was crazy. And then Cali, super dope. That was dope. That was dope also.
Oh, Melanie and I met for the first time face-to-face at BizCon.
Crazy. And y'all work together like every day. So it's so crazy.
Literally every day. Like literally we are on the phone. I have, you know, the baby makes a guest appearance on several of our staff calls. I mean, I feel like, you know, I know her. I know her partner. She knows my family. But this was the first time that we were able to actually like touch each other, you know, like just physically be in the same space.
Yeah, and I miss my babies making their guest appearances on my stuff, mm-hmm. man. It's a shame. Well, they had to go back to school, but I guess another sign that the world is kind of going in the right direction, even though I miss them.
Aww, that's beautiful. Wait, because I've seen a couple of the guest appearances.
Yeah, I have two daughters, a 7-year-old and a 3-year-old. And like being at home with working with them during the pandemic was definitely a dope experience because they've got to meet like so many people in the cannabis industry. My 7-year-old even says that she wants to work in cannabis. So dope that we get to influence them, you know, in that type of way.
So question for you, with the babies and with being in cannabis, how did you share with them like dad works in cannabis?
To be honest, my 7-year-old knows a lot more. Like she knows that cannabis is a plant. She knows that cannabis is a medicine and it helps people. As a matter of fact, like most of the negative stigma that people have or they've been taught about it, of course she doesn't have that because I would never teach her that. But I'll say it's this interesting thing where like as a parent, and I haven't quite figured out how to navigate it, is like like what? Because I, you know, I get nervous. Like, is she going to go to school and say the wrong thing, and they're going to be like trying to take the kids away? So you know, I get worried about that.
But to hear real quick, just to interject, I know we're laughing about it, but that's a real thing.
No, it's a real thing, and I I'm laughing about it, but it's really not funny at all. And I know people where that's been their real experience. But it's also been an interesting thing too, because like my kids are very vocal. So everybody knows that I work in cannabis. And so like at first, like I was in finance before. So it was one of those things where, I'll just wear what I sleep on my sleeve, what I do. It's a part of like a part of who I am as a person. So it was interesting. Like I was at Career Day speaking about finance like 1 year. And then like the next year I had made a new career. And so, like as my daughter goes to school and talks about it because she's proud of it. Like I at first I was nervous, but then I had like I won't say who at the school, but I've had different people from like her school come up to me and be like, hey, can you talk about medical cannabis or CBD or any of these things? It's really been interesting to know how many everyday people really want to know about what we do. And like, you're able to see that stigma kind of come down through their interactions with a real person. And so that's been like an enjoyable experience for me.
It's all on the road to how we normalize this, right? So your daughter feeling comfortable with speaking your truth and being proud of you is a part of normalizing this plant, you know, and helping, you don't know who at her school, like you said, people coming to you, like that has helped them kind of come out and, you know, and just be more open and forward with their needs, right? Like they up here suffering just because, you know, they're scared to talk about it, you know, and from the mouth of babes, right?
Oh my gosh, for sure. And like you said, that breaking that stigma down is so important, because I'll say at this point, it's not surprising anymore, but it really is eye-opening when you see people's minds and hearts change. Yeah. Like I have two family members that were in law enforcement, like that have, that are now using medical cannabis, that they're retired. Right. And both of them have like come to me and been like, yo, like, I can't believe I had to really like be locking people up for this. Right. And especially for like Black folks, like from our community, being a part of that and like knowing like this war on drugs that we've been sold, if you will, that was all bullshit. And now to know that like cannabis can be the thing to actually help you medically, or like seeing like members of my family that have been in like the military, have been able to use cannabis, how it's changed their lives. Just really, as this information starts to come, become more widely available, it's just amazing to see the way that, you know, the impact that it's having or changing on people. Even me getting into cannabis in the first place, on the learning about the legal cannabis industry, was about like that path was through my dad and medical cannabis. Now, he wasn't new to cannabis, because the conversation he had was like, son, I've been smoking weed since the 60s. What are you going to tell me? But like us learning together about the medical applications of cannabis is really what inspired me to get here. So I think it's such an important conversation we have to keep having.
I mean, you know, I'm gonna tag you and Melanie, because Melanie's background, and you probably heard this at y'all time in Ojai.
Thank you
in Ojai. But you know, Melanie is all about the ground, right? Like one of the things that she always says, and I love it, is reclaiming our ancestral medicine, right? Mm-hmm. So you know, you're speaking about your dad having been, you know, a part of this and enjoying the benefits of it since the 60s, right? And y'all being able to connect because of that.
Yeah.
And I think that's so special.
It's amazing. And I think it's what you're doing is beautiful, and how you're empowering your children is so it was arming them with such great intention, and how to naturally reclaim their medicine as well, and their healing and their right to healing, you know, because I mean, just surviving the war on drugs in itself is hard enough. And I know with my dad, I mean, there were a lot of challenges. He preferred using cannabis as his pain management regimen. But then he ended up, you know, during the Reagan years, he lost his job, ended up having to go work for the government, ended up having to subscribe to drug tests and things like that. And then it went from cannabis into alcohol, and it shifted our fucking world. You know, what that does, and especially how alcohol affects, you know, communities like mine, specifically, you know, so I really appreciate what you're doing, you know, and raising your kids in a positive environment like that.
Yeah, man. And you're right, because I think my dad was the same. His experience was, my dad retired from the railroad. So, you know, they had random drug tests the whole time. So he had to stop consuming during that time. But then us just even exploring together, back then it was 2018, even looking at how the industry had advanced so much, like, right, we only knew about flower. But then when you start getting into the indica sativas, the cannabinoids and terpenes, and you start talking about like other methods of consumption, you start, you know, the tinctures, the bombs, right?
Like concentrates,
all those different things. It opened up just a whole new world that a lot of us, where we came from, didn't even know existed.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, trying to continue to spread that message is definitely an important thing too.
Now question for you, because, you know, we mentioned family members working for the government or in industries where they're subjected to these testing. And so, you know, we have a president in office, right? Who, like, let's just be real, was put in office by people who look like us, right? Mm-hmm. Like urban areas, Black, you know, Latinx, Indigenous people. Like, we put him and VP Harris in office. We were the deciding factors, if you will.
Yeah, because if you don't, you're not Black, right? Ain't that what they said?
That's what they said. Yo, I don't know who was doing his PR, but I know they was just like, yo, Joe. Like,
now he was from the heart with that one. Nobody tell you, he was like, I'm speaking from the heart with that.
But you know, that's the thing that we love about Joe, right? Like, yeah, we know, like, you know,
he's keeping it real.
Exactly. You know, like, sometimes you want to do away with a lot of the political correctness.
For real, because that's a conversation. We really was like, he was right. But it's like, it's one of them things where it's like, we're just saying,
you don't say it?
Say that in public.
like that's what we talk about at home, right? But, you know, appreciate Joe for putting it out there. And actually, it made me feel better that he knew that. Okay, mm-hmm. So now that you know that, Joe, that we put you here, okay? Mm-hmm. When it came out that there were employees of the government who were let go of due to past consumption. Okay. And these were, you know, I won't even say low level, but I will say, you know, when you had VP Harris came, you know, coming out saying that, you know, back in the day in Oakland, you know, she partook. And I mean, you have all these people at upper levels being honest about their past consumption, but people actually being let go of. And so what was your take on that?
Well, you know, to take a step back, when we start talking about drug testing, I think that is something that overwhelmingly impacts, you know, minority communities. I think when you look at, for one, in my personal experience, when you even look at the type of jobs that they drug test for, typically those are the positions that are the ones that are held by people of color. I'll take my experience in banking as an example, right? Okay. To get the job as a teller, or like one of the bankers, like, or whatever, that are the everyday people that are helping most of the clients,
right?
You have to take a drug test for that, right? Like, whether, and but then when I was going to be a financial advisor, which are the positions where it was like only 1% of African Americans that held that position, guess what? I didn't get drug tested for those positions anymore.
That part.
So when you look at like those barriers that even keep people being able to get professional opportunities. No. Whether it's like, so that's why it was a great thing to see Amazon change their position and say that they're not going to drug test people anymore. Because commonly, like when you look at those warehouse positions, again, like in different jobs like that, who's the ones that are typically working those jobs, right? So you're disenfranchising people and keeping people out from certain positions from like the drug testing thing in the first place. And everybody knows that, again, that Blacks, whites, you know, Hispanics, Indigenous people tend to be using cannabis at the same rates.
Correct.
But you're in these barriers and the types of positions that our people are typically in to try to keep them out. So, again, I think that it's a great thing that we're seeing like this trend towards going towards drug testing. Because, for one, we talk about marijuana drug testing. You can't tell if you're high on the job or not anyway, right? Like, you smoked a month ago and it could still be in your system. And then furthermore, I think that there's evidence that shows, I think there was actually a new report. It was one of the sports leagues. But anyway, in many ways, cannabis doesn't impact your performance in the ways, like the things that you're trying to protect people from on the job in the first place. So
yes.
I think it's important that we have rules that match that. But I'll also say at the same time, you know, that's not to say that responsible consumption isn't important. You know, that people aren't managing it in a certain type of way. Like, you know, if you have a job, public safety, you know, you should be able to, you know, go to work and operate. But also at the same time, if people are using other prescription drugs or have the ability to use alcohol, which can be more damaging, I think it's important that we recognize cannabis for what it is. But at the same time, people have the ability and the option to practice responsible consumption the same way they would with another medicine or alcohol or something else.
You know, all very good points. I mean, I think one of the things that Melanie and I talk about all the time is that we're adults, right? And so this trend of over-policing, and especially, as you pointed out, in positions where they're primarily held by people of color, is very demeaning. And especially when, exactly, like you go to work, you could have smoked the night before. Why are you policing what I do in my personal time? As long as I don't come to your job and I'm not outside your facility, you know, partaking or in your facility or whatever the case may be, or putting someone at in harm's way or in danger, then I don't really understand why you are policing what grown people do in their personal time. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, another piece that kind of adds to that is the differentiation they try to make between medical and between adult use. Because at the end of the day, like, I grew up in one of those neighborhoods. Like, I'm from upstate New York, I'm from Buffalo. I grew up in one of those neighborhoods that was like heavily impacted, heavily criminalized due to policies of the war on drugs. And everyone I knew who consumed were just trying to feel better. Like, they were just trying to make it through the day. And the honest part of that is that there is so much undiagnosed PTSD, anxiety, physical ailments, especially because a lot of people who look like us are in working wage, working class, blue collar jobs where they're doing a lot with their bodies. And so all of these people, like I said, who I grew up around, they were just trying to feel better. But we have these terms of, well, it's okay for medical, or these thoughts, it's okay for medical, but not okay for this, that I think, you know, really kind of puts consumers and those who are just trying to heal and trying to seek wellness and balance against each other.
For sure. No, I'm a firm believer of that. And I know, like, when I was first starting in the industry, one of the first books I read was Steve D'Angelo's Cannabis Manifesto. And I don't know if he created this idea, but it was the first place that I heard it, that even if he had the theory that all cannabis consumption is medical cannabis use, right? Like, just like you said, even if you don't know it, you may think you're doing it recreationally, if you will. But the fact of the matter is, there's so many different, like you said, whether it's PTSD, anxiety, or so many disorders that we're self-medicating to try to heal. And cannabis has been something for years and generations and centuries, you know, prior to the war on drugs, that we've known it to be able to do that, and cultures have been able to, you know, use it in that way. So I think that that's, you know, really important. I agree with you that it really doesn't make sense to necessarily, while medical cannabis is important, I think that this, you know, that the differentiation between the two and how people use it, it's important that people understand that, right? That that even this criminalization of some people using it, if it's not in a medical way, doesn't really serve anybody, right? Like, when we look at the war on drugs, 50 years of people being arrested, you know, getting records, has there really been any positive impact from that? Because I really can't see it, right? I think what we've created is where, if you ever got arrested for cannabis, how many, I can't tell you how many people I know could not get financial aid because they got caught with weed. So now you have a system where people can't get educations and better themselves, get better careers. How many people have not gotten the good job because they've been had cannabis on their record, or they drug tested for cannabis, right? And furthermore, like you said, talking about coming out of certain communities, like, I grew up in Trenton, New Jersey, right? Like, I know that personally, I can say that I've been pulled over more than 70 times in my life. Almost the majority of all those times been stopped, searched, what have you. And so I can say that I'm lucky and blessed that the reason that I'm even being able to stand in here is because, like, I came and had parents that were able to support me getting lawyers, or, you know, made sure that I did whatever to not make it. But most of my friends weren't so lucky. And so I can say that almost every person that a lot of people that I grew and knew up with have been, like, real victims, right? Like, actually been arrested, actually been charged. I've been there myself. And so I think it's so important that we really change the system to make sure that as we are building this industry, right, we're talking $24 billion, the projected U.S. number this year, that we don't still have people being arrested for the same thing that is now a multi-billion-dollar industry in our country. So,
you know, so a couple of thoughts, right? The first thought is, I will say, is that I think all of this is working the way it was intended, right? Because if you look at the breakdown, they start to predict beds for jails based on third grade pre-testing numbers. Mm-hmm. And so it's not...
Say that again for the people in the back, like loud, so people really know what the fuck is up.
Yeah, so like third grade pre-testing, based on those results, that's what they use to start building and making the arguments for needing more jails, more beds, right? So I say that to say the system is working the way they intended to, because I really don't think that they want critical thinkers. I think that they want people who will just perform, right? Like basically robots. And so if you're keeping people out of school, if you're kicking them out of school, to your point, if you are stopping them from getting financial aid, if you're stopping them from being able to get an education, stopping them from being able to work, well, anyway it goes, we're going to get this labor from you. Either we're going to get free labor from you in jail, where you're basically getting pennies and it's just an extension of, you know, of slavery, or out in the world, you're not going to be able to make a living wage. And so you're going to be working 60, 70, 80 hours a week. Like, we're going to get it from you anyway.
From
you
debt slavery then.
Anyway we can. Exactly. So we're going to get it from you. I don't know if you're following, from you being in Jersey, I don't know if you're following what's going on, and you're actually, you probably are, because you everywhere, you pay attention to everything.
Tahir knows what's up.
Right, so I know you're following what's going on in New York. So they recently had the CCB board, you know, is finally fleshed out. They had their second meeting, and Tremaine Wright, who is the chair of the CCB, came out with comments about illegal trades, right? Like basically, hey, it's not federally, it's not regulated yet in the state. And so if you are allowing someone to buy a shirt and then gifting them, or if you're, you know, if you're doing these things on the adult use side, there are going to be heavy fines attached to it, right? I'm summarizing, but that was the gist of her comment. And so, you know, it gave us some pause, because what I thought initially about was, well, what about the people who look like us who won't be able to pay those hefty fines? Now we're getting back into recriminalization, because are they going to be arrested? Like now they're going to be put into the system for something that is, you know, being regulated. But because there was a governor who kind of slowed down that track, and because rules and regs take time to develop, you know, people are in this gray area. They're at this, in this hold. What are your thoughts on that? On, you know, criminalization being attached to, or these hefty fines being attached to adult use that hasn't been fully regulated.
Yeah. And of course, as you know, I'm following it, and really looking at it with the lens of, it's interesting to watch like the conversation, how it's playing out in New York and actually here in D.C. where I live in the same week. Right. So in D.C.
Yeah, because the mayor just changed some shit in D.C.
Yeah. And I think most people know that in D.C. we've probably had what's one of the most robust, I guess you could say, gray markets in the country, because when they legalized cannabis here several years ago, they were never allowed to create like an adult use.
There was a rider. There was a rider that prevented y'all from using.
Right. The Harris rider. Right. Yeah. So because D.C. is not a state, Congress has the ability through the appropriations process to control certain laws that are passed in D.C. So because of that, an adult use cannabis market never got stood up. So again, this, the market where you go buy a lighter for $50 and you just happen to get some free weed is the way a lot of people doing business here in D.C. And so now in D.C., you're starting to see it. You're starting to, like, they just proposed that they were going to start cracking down on gray market operators through the same way, through a hefty fine. It was going to be like a fine for like $30,000, which, of course, they're not going to lock you up. But as you said, if you get a fine, you don't pay the fine, guess you get warrants. You ultimately still get the same result.
Yep.
I'll say I'm still trying to unpack what it means. So like earlier in the summer, we saw the we saw the DC police chief
start
to make reports and talk about how they were seeing increased activity, like robberies and things like that because of cannabis. It's interesting because, again, selling weed isn't anything that's new, right? It's not like it just came out like a couple years ago when they legalized. So you would think that like whatever volume of crime or whatever that's associated with the underground market has already been there, right? It's not new. Part of what you see happening now, going back to what you said in New York, I make the connection. I know they said that they're not going to legalize until now. They're saying like it's likely going to be 2023 before those licenses come out. So we have all these entrepreneurs that have, in all honesty, probably really always been doing business in this space. Now they've just found a type of way to make it where they're a little bit more protected and they're not getting locked up. And what you see is happening is, So I will say that there probably is some degree of public safety to it, but a lot of what's happening is now that you have the like operators in certain states, they don't want to see their bottom line hurt. I can't say it in any more real way than that because people are still supporting the underground market. In my opinion, I think what needs to be done, I think the solution is, I think that we need to have actual cannabis licensing programs that actually give people a real shot at being able to participate in the industry. And then there would be no need for a gray market or legacy market or black market, whatever you want to call it, right? If we have a system where it costs thousands or millions of dollars to be able to get into the industry, you have to have like a professional resume of all this cannabis experience and what you may have been doing 5, 10, 20 years doesn't count. Like what better, and this is coming from somebody that's on the corporate side of cannabis, like what better option or path do you give them, right? Like I think about somebody like where I grew up, Weed Man. He's been selling weed across the street from City Hall like as long as I can remember. And somebody like that.
I heard about him, yeah.
One of my, right, like, but these are people that have been like my inspirations like before I ever got into this game, right?
Yeah.
And so like when you think of, again, like somebody like that, like give him a path to be able to legally be in the industry, and he wouldn't be doing that. He doesn't want to be selling weed illegally, but it's like you don't give him a chance to.
And it so is, it is what it is, right? Like we're gonna make a way. That's what we do.
And so I do think that regulated cannabis is important, right? Like I think the vape crisis from a couple years ago is an example of that, and how we need to make sure that we do have regulations for consumer safety, a bunch of different reasons. But also at the same time, I think that we just need to give people a pathway to actually get in the game. Like if you're going to lock people, that's just human nature. If you're going to lock people out and not have them be a part of an opportunity, especially one that traditionally they've been using as an avenue to feed their families, right? Because if we talk about displacement, is who's really being displaced.
Yep.
Like you could say that they're hurting your bottom lines and your profits, but they may have been there doing business before you. So I think that for one, if we talk about public-private partnerships, companies, and this is a lot of the work that I'm trying to do, right, to try to find ways to create a pathway so that people can get into the industry, whether it's education, access to capital, creating good policies that actually give them a road to be able to do it. So I think that that's the way, you know, the business side of the industry can support. From a policy side of the standpoint, not things like not having license caps, not having capital requirements, not having real estate requirements.
That's a big one.
Business are big things that you can do to also, you know, move the industry forward and give more people a chance.
Yeah, I mean, I think the reality is, historically, people have always figured out ways of getting around, right? I mean, even with alcohol, there are still bootleggers. That's not something that's going to go away. And so we have to stop making these rules and policies for the outliers. What really needs to happen is that, and to your point, how are we transitioning in legacy operators? How are we transitioning in people who have who are basically the reason why we are regulating? It's because they show just how profitable this industry is. How are we transitioning them in a way that is not demeaning, in a way that does not have them jumping through, you know, hoops and basically just being overwhelmed? And how are we making sure that they are supported in that transition? So Tahir, it has been amazing to have you on. We got to do this again. We're going to have like a regular. Yeah.
Look, now, this is dope. I had like another hour left.
Listen. We got some back to backs, but yo, like we have to, yeah, we got to figure this out. Like you and I, like we got to definitely chop it up. We got to definitely chop it up.
We got to do that Ruby Slipper recap.
We just really talking about the system. We ain't even really
talking about that,
but we can continue. It's a conversation we can continue. Like I said, as you see, this is what I love to do. You know, like I really think of this cannabis movement, like really in all reality, as I like look at these people behind me. Like of our generation, this is the new civil rights movement, right? This is what I've seen, like all of my friends like lose their opportunity. This is what I've seen so many people locked up for, and not even talk about other people. This is what I personally experienced. And so for us to be able to making strides to make this legal and really change the game for everybody is so important. Thank you for the work y'all are doing, leading in business and the culture. And thanks for having me, man. I'm down anytime to come back and do this.
Yo, absolutely. Listen, bro. I have notes because I'm like, yo, we got to talk about this. We got to talk about this. 30 minutes always goes too quickly.
It always goes too quickly.
So we're gonna wind up having a part two, a part three, a part four. Like, look, as stuff comes down the pipe, we gonna kick it. We gonna connect. So, question for you: Are you gonna be in San Fran?
For the NCIA joint, yes, I'll be there, and I'll be at Black CannaCon in New Orleans too. If you're
so I'm gonna be at Black CannaCon, so I will see you in New Orleans, and we're gonna be in San Fran for NCIA. We're actually throwing the official after party, so
bet
tons of opportunity for us to chop it up.
Bet, yeah, I'll see you there then for sure.
Yeah,
we'll have some extra smoke this for you.
Hey, let's get it. You know,
just like in no high.
Right. Yeah, I'll tell you, I'm one of those cannabis people that actually smokes.
I know that. So we'll make sure we have a sesh too on the blog or on the podcast.
Absolutely. Absolutely. All right, bro. Well, peace and blessings. Thank you so much for coming to talk bluntly with us. And until NOLA, I will see you in NOLA.
Yeah, a couple weeks. Let's get it.
Absolutely.
Oh, having a VIP reception there the first day. So make sure y'all pull up.
Oh, I'm not on the list.
Oh, girl, you on the list. What you mean?
Oh, CG here. Now you have a plus one.
We on this
now
list.
Plus one.
Okay. Perfect. Perfect. All right, Joe. Well, I will see you there. Y'all know what it is. The people are Blunt, Fidrika Easley, Melanie Davis, and Mr. Tahir Johnson.
Yes.
Thank you for the work you do.
Stay blunted, y'all.